Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Francisco L. Borges and the Melville Charitable Trust.
The Connecticut Center for Arts and Technology, or CONCAT, was started a decade ago in New Haven. It provides GED and job training programs, entrepreneurial support for adults, and after-school programs for students. The idea is modeled after an innovative program in Pittsburgh that's part of the Manchester Bidwell Corporation. It's a one-stop shop that changes the lives of underserved communities. This is Disrupted. I'm Kalila Brown-Dean. Later, we'll talk about why community college enrollment has dropped during the pandemic. But first, Eric Clemens. He's been head of CONCAT for the past decade, and he stepped down this year to focus on redeveloping neighborhoods. He's now executive chairman of the Connecticut Outreach Revitalization Program, or CONCORP. It's the economic development arm of CONCAT. Later, he'll talk about his role in the Dalio Philanthropies partnership that was supposed to help kids in struggling school districts, but it fell apart last year. And he'll talk about the legacy of his wife, Sharon, who died of COVID in November. I asked him to first talk about the idea behind CONCAT as it was being imagined in 2011.
The idea was to bring market-relevant job training to folks in Newhallville and Dixwell especially, but also surrounding New Haven. Secondly, we wanted to bring arts after-school and summer programming to kids and use the arts as a vehicle for academic achievement. And then thirdly, we added a third leg of the stool, which was entrepreneurship. Young people who may not have the wherewithal or the wish to go to college, but have an entrepreneurial spirit. We wanted to identify that entrepreneurial spirit and create a way for those kids to live a life of potential. And so we started an entrepreneurship academy, actually with Quinnipiac University, and now has gone statewide with Waterbury, Bridgeport, Hamden and Fairfield, kids from all over. 80 kids now are in our entrepreneurship academy, but three legs of the stool to really think about ways in which people can live out their potential while at the same time have a life of dignity. So that was the main goal for us.
That life of dignity and creating opportunities for that was launched in Pittsburgh and mm-hmm. became a part of this broader, at the time national, but now international effort to mm-hmm. help people live that life of dignity. Even though there was a framework in Pittsburgh through the Manchester Bidwell Corporation, what was the challenge of creating that sort of center in New Haven and creating opportunities for people living in those neighborhoods you mentioned?
Oh man, there were many challenges, Doc. One was we had chose to build our site in Science Park, which is a Yale branded property, as you know, and not knowing the history of Science Park, where the park intentionally or originally was supposed to be created as a response to Winchester Repeating Arms closing down. And so that space, those acres would be for more kind of industry and factory work for folks who lived in the community who lost their job because Winchester shut down. And they reversed the idea of doing that and created biotech bioscience hubs, thus being named Science Park. And so we came into that space not knowing that story. And quite frankly, they had built gates and walls around that space. And you know, you had to kind of stop to come through Science Park. Folks who are indigenous to the community, we didn't know that. We thought Science Park was ideal because it was in the midst of cutting edge technology, hence the name technology in our name. While in this, at the same time, in probably the most depressed neighborhood in New Haven, and so it was very difficult for folks from the community to take us serious, thus trust us. Because we had set up shop in a place that, quite frankly, did not keep their promise to the community. And so that took us some doing. But I think the bigger piece to this in terms of the difficulty in doing what we were doing was getting folks to believe that what we are doing is for them. That everything and everything we provide, as you know, is free of charge. It is at no cost to anyone. And so, again, the most difficult challenge for us was getting folks to believe that, one, it is for them, and two, even worse, they deserve it. They deserve what we are building. And so it took us some time to whittle down the mountain of distrust, if you will, where folks will now come and we can serve them what we have and really advance our mission because now they are on mission with us.
There are physical barriers and physical challenges to that kind of inclusion that you mentioned. But often the result of this is, as you said, the skepticism about who are you and why are you coming into this community? What's in it for you? And you mentioned having to overcome those challenges and hurdles. As you look back at your time at Concat, what are you most proud of?
Wow. I'm proud of a couple of things. One, I wanted to create a staff of people that would be empathetic to the sting of unemployment because we were doing workforce development. And so I remember when it was time for me to start hiring people because I had this mountain of work. Now I needed help. I went to our board chair and I said, you know, there I have like 200 resumes of people who are looking for work. Most of the resumes are people who are unemployed. I said, I think we should hire folks who do not have a job right now. And so everyone, when we opened, everyone that I hired was most recently unemployed. And I'm really, really proud of that. And I look at these folks, someone like Genevieve Walker, who is now the CEO and president, who came in when our door, you know, she was there maybe a month and 2 months before the doors opened. She was unemployed. She is now the CEO. I'm really proud of that. I'm proud that the community sees Concat as a community citadel now, and it's a trusted vehicle for change, not only in the community, not only in the city, but in the state, quite frankly, in the country, right? It's one of the premier nonprofits in the country, quite frankly. And so I'm proud of the work that we've done. And I'm proud that I could leave, right? I'm proud I left the right way. You know, we had a succession plan and we worked it for the last 4 years. And I don't think a nonprofit leader, especially one who is founding, should be in that in their position more than 10 years. And this was 10 years, and I didn't want to stay and not be relevant anymore, right? My leadership not be relevant. And so I'm really proud that I had the courage to leave and the humility to leave.
Eric, you talked about investing in your staff with intention and investing in their potential in a way that many others do not. New Haven is known as an eds and meds city, and often that means limited opportunities for other people. I want you to think about how the pandemic affected the work of Concat, because now it's never just been about the programs, but it certainly, I would imagine, became complicated. Talk to our listeners about how dealing with these dual pandemics affected the work at Concat.
Yeah, it did impact the work. We had to close down. And as you know, we have workforce development programs, two in the medical field and the other in culinary arts, and all the restaurants closed. So what are we to do? Also, what was important to me was the staff, whether it be from our security guard, Idis Wilson, to myself, 24, 25 people. I wanted to make sure that those folks in the midst of this pandemic did not lose a paycheck. And so what I did was I started raising money to ensure that our staff especially stayed on point, stayed on mission, advanced our mission, even if they're not in the building. Secondly, we realized that a lot of our families and our students were struggling and suffering along with the folks in the community. And we wanted to raise money to help those folks. What we set out to do was raise money, raise a COVID-19 relief fund with an aim of $600,000. And what we would do was give out $400 debit cards to folks in Dixwell, in Newhallville, and our parents of our kids in our programs and people who are in our programs who are really suffering due to COVID. And so we were able to raise about $520,000 in the maybe 3 weeks we raised that money. And so for months, we gave out $400 every month to folks who were struggling and really gave the money away. We then started thinking about, okay, people are really hungry as well. And so I was able to work with a market, Elm City Market, downtown, and they allowed me to leverage their food distribution lines. And because, as you know, food at the time was not being distributed, it was actually going to waste because the restaurants were closed, we were able to reroute that food distribution. And Concat, we have a restaurant called Orchid Cafe. Orchid Cafe became a food hub and a food distribution center for the neighborhoods. So those are some of the things that we had to do in terms of pivoting to help people while at the same time try and get our programming back on track, because we still had students who were looking for things to do and wanted to continue their education. But it was a pivoting to really advancing the mission in a different way.
You wrote an op-ed in the Connecticut Mirror, and it was called, "When People Are Putting Their Bodies on the Line, the Least We Can Do is Support Them." And I want to raise a line from your op-ed that really struck me. And in the letter that you sent out for communities, you said, "We're committed to proclaim the power of justice through service and through a concerted effort exact the wrongs of poverty." Why do you see addressing poverty as a moral imperative that then needs to be embraced by community?
Yeah, that's such a great question. I grew up really poor and always wondering who was going to come help me. And folks never really coming. The one solace that I had was a place called the Carver Community Center. I'm from Norwalk, Connecticut. And that community center really raised me. And so I know the profound sting of poverty, to your point earlier, not only a physical pain, but a psychic pain that poverty creates in the mind of people. And so I think a lot of times, if not all the time and too often, there is a focus and a deep concentration on the manifestations of poverty as opposed to addressing poverty itself. Poverty is the enemy, and we have the means to get rid of poverty. We do, but we'd rather kind of program poverty out, because I think a lot of times folks who have the means, they want to do something about poverty, but they don't want to be next to poor people while doing it. And so I think poverty is our number one issue. It is. I don't think it is education disparity. I don't think it is housing disparity, although those things are evil as well. I think those things are wrought from poverty. And if until poverty is addressed, we will never, ever exact the wrongs of poverty, right? We will never do it. It is, to me, the most profound evil that has been created outside of slavery. Actually, it is a manifestation of slavery.
Eric Clemens is the founder of Concat, the Connecticut Center for Arts and Technology. He just stepped down as CEO after a decade. Coming up, he'll talk about his focus now with the Connecticut Outreach Revitalization Program and about his role as chair of the board of a public-private partnership between the state and Dalio Philanthropies. This is Disrupted. Stay with us. Welcome back to Disrupted. I'm Kalila Brown-Dean. Later, we'll talk to a Washington Post reporter about how community college admission rates have dropped dramatically due to the pandemic. But now, let's continue our conversation with Eric Clemens. He's the founder of CONCAT, the Connecticut Center for Arts and Technology in New Haven, and he's stepping down as CEO after a decade. He's now the executive chairman of the Connecticut Outreach Revitalization Program, or CONCORP. It's the economic development arm of CONCAT. I asked him to talk about his role at CONCORP and the new $200 million project that they are taking on to transform Dixwell Plaza. The goal is to create a mixed-use housing, commercial, and cultural hub that he's working on in partnership with businessman Carlton Highsmith.
You know, Mr. Highsmith and I thought about, maybe 3 years ago, I was really thinking, we have hundreds of graduates who have went through our medical training programs in our culinary school and parents who have come to CONCAT and become family. And what is the next iteration of impact we can make for them? They are seeing life differently. They have a job now. They want to own a home. They want to own cars. All of these things, they see the world differently and they walk in the world differently with a different gait. And so what could we do to create the world that they now envision for themselves? And so we said, all right, let's start this economic development arm of our nonprofit that will create housing, that will create entrepreneurship opportunities, that will create retail. And so we've set our sights on Dixwell Plaza, given that it has been in decline and forgotten for decades. And I felt like this was an absolute shame, given that Dixwell Avenue is the main, in my opinion, the main artery in New Haven. You had this Black historic neighborhood that was allowed to be in decline for decades. And we wanted to do something about that. Now, given, again, going back to the word dignity, given that we are looking to create dignity in communities, this, in our opinion, and definitely in mine, this community and this tract of land especially had no dignity at all. And again, was intentionally left to decline. And so we set our sights on Dixwell Plaza, which is a urban renewal, old kind of strip mall, and eight and a half acres. And we said, you know what, let's try and redevelop this plot of land, thus trying to transform this community and make it a beacon of light again, not only for just the city, but also for Black people again. And so we started acquiring those properties. We set up the formation of the organization. I sat with the community for a year and a half, listening to what they want and need. And based on what I heard, we then master planned that site and programmed it based on community information.
One of the things that we heard last year was that, you know, there's a report in Forbes that said nearly half of Black-owned businesses were wiped out because of COVID. On every measure, that disparity has been concentrated within communities of color broadly, but in particular Black communities. And now we're hearing that the Treasury Department has made this $9 billion commitment to minority-owned businesses. But we also know that even with the PPP program, the people who needed access to those funds couldn't get it because they didn't have the infrastructure that other companies had to do that. How will CONCORP address that disparity to support Black-owned businesses who are local to the community and committed to the community and not just to their profit margin?
Great, great penetrating question. One, I launched an economic justice fund for that very reason, right? That 45% of the Black businesses in the country were shuttering. They were falling apart and closing. And so what could we do instead of playing the short game in terms of COVID relief with food distribution and debit cards? How do we play the long game as well, right? To ensure that if in fact there is economic infrastructure in these Black communities through Black entrepreneurship, how do we continue that economic infrastructure and continue this capital formation in these communities? And so we launched the Economic Justice Fund. We were able to raise $200,000 and we got a match for another $200,000 from the state. So now we have $400,000 that will go to Black businesses, Black business owners in mostly Dixwell and New Hallville, and also technical assistance that will go to those folks. And that would be accounting, accounting capacities, insurance capacities, consultants, you know, how to build your business, those types of things. We're bringing that to bear for those Black business owners as well. Secondly, we are poised to take hold of a 40,000 square foot building, and we'll probably close on it very soon. And we are going to start the Concord Community Economic Impact Lab. And it will be a building dedicated to minority-owned businesses, incubating those businesses, mostly from the community, and launching those businesses as well. So I'm very, very, very excited about that. Myself, Mr. Highsmith, Paul McCraven, Anna Blanding, who you all, you know, all these folks, we're putting that together now. We have a business plan. We're actually looking for an executive director to run this because, you know, I don't want to run it. I will until we find somebody to do it, but it's a 40,000 square foot building that is poised to incubate minority owned businesses, mostly in the community. So we're addressing that issue head on. Which is, again, part of me kind of building a bigger boat is to launch this economic impact lab.
Part of what you've done in your career is to think beyond the problems that are before us and to think in innovative ways how we reach solutions. And you are part of this private-public partnership with the state, Advancing Education, and Dalio Philanthropies. And that partnership fell apart because of all of these questions. What do you think the state needs to learn from that, Eric, as we think about the challenges that continue to be present in Connecticut and how we move not just past them, but through them?
Yeah, that the Partnership for Connecticut, you know, it was born out of a couple of ideas. And a lot of people know this, you know, myself and a young man who works at Dalio Philanthropies, who a dear friend of mine, Andrew Ferguson, and I would have dinner monthly for years and talk about ways in which we can help youth, because, you know, youth very much like middle class are the forgotten people, right? And so you know, for years we did this and with Barbara and Ray Dalio, thinking about ways to do this, and kind of the Partnership for Connecticut was born as you mentioned, a public-private partnership that potentially $300 million were dedicated to disengaged, disconnected youth in the state of Connecticut, where there are over 45,000 of these young people who are disengaged, disconnected from school, from a whole bunch of things in life. And we were bringing to bear potentially $300 million, definitely $200 million. $100 million from private, $100 million from public. And we would raise another $100 million. 80%, 85% of these young people are Black kids. And so I was one of those kids. And so, of course, I was all in and actually chaired the board of this endeavor. And it was so fraught with politics in a deep way. And not just politics, but adversarial politics. Because the statute called for politicians to be on the board of this endeavor. And I would go as far as saying also, if the 85% of those kids who needed the help didn't look like me, I think things would have went differently. And I say this now because I said that to the people who were involved. And not all folks behave badly. Not all, actually not many. And so what I would say is to the state that if in fact you are serious about helping those kids who need the most help, and if we are serious about creating a wider and deeper tax base in a way where these kids can now become employees somewhere or entrepreneurs somewhere that will take a burden off the wealthy, then leave politics at home. We can help people. Like, the things you see that are happening in the state is because people care about them. Things that you don't see happening is because people don't care about them. And so this brilliant idea, in my opinion, that had could have been a national model in helping kids who everyone look away from, right? That's why I love Barbara and Ray, especially, because they run to the trouble, right? They'll sit with you and say, Eric, what do you think? Because we don't know. But they'll run to where the help is needed. And so I would urge the state that to have some real moral courage in helping those who need the most help, right? The poverty conversation now is underway, where, as you know, I've been preaching this, and I'm not taking credit, I've been preaching this for a decade now, but it was always about biotech, bioscience, but you know, all these things that are not part of the value set of folks who need the most help. But now there is a huge turnaround where folks now, the whole entire country, not just the state, want to address poverty. When in fact, myself and you as well, and other folks have been preaching the issue of poverty for a decade now. And so there has to be some moral courage, and there has to be some moral fortitude and just some heart as it relates to especially our young people that the partnership was trying to reach. Now, there were other issues that came about, as other issues do, right? Especially with a startup organization. But again, I will say that if in fact, this is just my opinion, if those kids, that 85% of those kids didn't look like me, I think things would have went differently.
You have been devoted to running to the problem and running to the fire to help people for such a long time. And in the midst of fighting for community last year, you lost your wife, Sharon. Yeah. Eric, talk about the legacy that she leaves behind and how that motivates you to continue doing the work that you do.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning her, because I was going to, you know, when I was thinking about going to pick up all the food and distributing it, she was right with me. And, you know, and I know you can understand this, and hopefully others who are listening can, like, she was like my covering, you know. She was the person, like, at the end of this interview, she would say, good job. Or, you know, you probably need to say this or say that. In her legacy, I mean, she was just exquisite and the most sweetest, most determined, brilliant woman. She had it all. And because she chose to help, because she chose, she's a business owner, she's a very successful entrepreneur, because she chose to put herself out there as opposed to staying at home and covering up, she lost her life to COVID. And, you know, she came home one day, Kalila, and one evening, and she said to me, she laid down and she said, you know, I don't feel too good. And she laid down, and then she went upstairs and laid down some more. And from that utterance, she was gone in 2 weeks. And, you know, what I chose to do was start a fund in her name to honor her, just her amazing spirit in life, called the Butterflies Fund. And Sharon loved butterflies because she always felt like people had the opportunity to transform, right? If in fact they held still long enough to do so. And so we have four daughters, and these young ladies, we loved education, as you know. And these young ladies went to some really great schools. And so I chose to start a fund in her name, in her honor. And the money in that fund will go to scholarships for Black women who attend the colleges, Smith College, our oldest daughter went to Tuskegee University, our second daughter, Hampton University, our third daughter, and Spelman College, our fourth daughter, who's a junior at Spelman now. Scholarships will go to those Black women who attend those schools. And to this point, it's been four months since her passing. March 3rd, last week, 4 months, we've raised $1.6 million in 4 months. And that money will go to young Black women who are attending those four colleges that our daughters attend. But, it just, you know this, because you know me personally, it just rocked me. I mean, absolutely rocked me, because this was not the plan. You know, our plan was that we would do this, and then we would kind of build our ministry of helping people as we retired, and just go and just give things to people. That was our plan. Whatever it is that we had to give, we give. We pay our tithing to people, not to a church. And Sharon was very adamant about that, and I followed suit, because she understood the power of giving. And really, my healing has been just helping other people. And so that is her legacy. And it was not the plan. You know, I still have like moments of deep sadness. And at the same times, I have moments of pure joy and light because of my remembrance of her. And so, yeah, you know, she was just a powerhouse of humanity.
That commitment to healing, the commitment to helping other people, and the beauty of what you said about if people are still long enough, they can blossom into that potential. As you think about the next steps of your journey, Eric, what's motivating you, or what's giving you hope about the possibility of community to continue to develop and flourish?
What's giving me hope is, wow, that's a great question. I think what's giving me the most hope is the fact that other people are listening, that whatever position God has put me in at this point of my life has given me credibility in a way that those who can help even more are listening to me and believing in the things that I'm saying, because I have done everything that I said I would do. That's really, really important to me. And that gives me hope, because it allows for those folks who have been the most resourced to be in community, in authentic concert with those who have the least. And in bringing those people together, I think a very powerful thing happened, because I think people who have the most come in contact or proximity with those who have the least and think they are going to teach, but they actually learn more than they have taught. And I think that is a very powerful thing, if in fact we can avail ourselves in a real way to each other and realize that we are no different from each other, that the suffering is redemptive on both ends, that we are all, if you are human, you are suffering in some way, right? And if you can be honest about that, that we all need an ounce of love every day, right? And that I believe this is a deep belief I have. I believe we all have a masterpiece within us. And the thrust of our being is to reveal that masterpiece to the world. And most often, the revealing is because we are in concert or in relationship with others in a way where that thing that is in us comes out and we present it to the world. And it doesn't matter how much money you have or how much money you do not have, right? And so I'm very hopeful, because I've been allowed to be a bridge to two worlds and a believable one, right? And so that is an honor that I hold. So that to me gives me hope.
Eric Clemens is the founder of the Connecticut Center for Arts and Technology in New Haven, and he's now executive chairman of the Connecticut Outreach Revitalization Program. Eric, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, dear sister. It's a pleasure.
Coming up, we'll talk about the future of community colleges. This is Disrupted. Stay with us. Welcome back to Disrupted. I'm Kalila Brown-Dean. It's not unusual for community colleges to see a surge in enrollment during a bad economic year. But that's not what happened during the coronavirus pandemic. Community college enrollment plummeted, with 10% fewer students at the beginning of the year compared with 2019. That's more students lost than any other sector in higher education. Our next guest has been writing about this issue. Danielle Douglas Gabriel is a reporter covering the economics of higher education for the Washington Post. I asked her to talk about the landscape for community colleges right now.
Oftentimes, the community colleges pull a cross-section of low-income students, some middle-income and upper-income students who are looking for ways to lower the cost of their education, lots of Black and Latinx students, but also lots of middle-class white students. But what we saw in the last year is that while the initial projections were, well, maybe a lot of people are going to end up going to community college, it's an affordable option in order to stay on the course for your education without having to worry too much about money. But the duration of the pandemic and the economic disruption that it has caused really rattled the core population of a lot of community colleges, especially adult learners. So for most community colleges, the average age of their students is about 25, some of them as high as 38. And these are people who are going to school part-time, working full-time, taking care of families, raising children. And when they had to make the decisions of whether to stay home with their kids in order to help them with their education, they put their own education on a back burner. Or when finances were just did not materialize the way they thought it would, that also became a problem. And for students who are coming out of high school, going into college, some of them decided that the finances just wouldn't work. Others realized that a lot of the four-year institutions were a lot more open and more welcoming of them. And they figured, well, if I'm going to do this, I might as well go straight into the four-year schools, some of which were offering tuition discounts in order to draw more folks. So they were kind of grappling with all of those factors playing out at the same time.
There seems to be so much diversity baked into the population that attends community colleges, but also the approach to serving those populations, whether you have older people who are looking for a career change or younger students who need that sort of extra push to figure out what they want to do in life, or those who say, I need the skills development and the training to have it. But why then in the United States do we even see community colleges burgeoning? We know that this emphasis on education in many ways is uniquely American, but then the community college system seems to be even more unique for the US.
It's a practical and efficient pathway towards post-secondary education. And I use post-secondary education as a broad term that is inclusive of career training, that is also inclusive of short-term skills training, right? So you can learn to be a plumber at a community college. This isn't something that traditional four-year colleges really are very bothered with these days, but community college really takes on that role of the everything for everybody. And it's before the pandemic, about 40% of undergrads attended community colleges. Certainly, the enrollment has fallen off, but I think there's a reason why the Biden administration, particularly Dr. Jill Biden, who, by the way, is a community college professor at Northern Virginia Community College, she's still teaching, which is wild to me, but there's a reason why they have really honed in on the idea of community colleges as the economic engines, because they can do so much for so many people at a much lower cost than other segments of higher education.
I think even the very name community college implies that we see this access to education, this access to career development and training as being central to economic development, but also fostering those ties. What are you seeing within the Biden administration to address this, address the reality of not just declining enrollments, but the importance and the need to have job training and future opportunities for people who would usually go to community college?
I think candidate Biden had a very bold and expansive plan for how to support community colleges. Now, that meant tuition-free community college, which was a program that came about during the Obama administration that never quite made it to the federal level. But I will say lots of states, including Connecticut, have pushed forward with their own tuition-free promise programs for community colleges. So Biden wants to take that up. He also wants to, or said he would consider something akin to the Title I program in K-12, where money follows schools that really support and serve low-income, high proportions of low-income students, which naturally benefit community colleges as well. And, you know, one of the things that community colleges have been very successful at, and the Biden administration says it wants to support, is the idea of wraparound services. So emergency grant aid, he has said he'd like to make a more federal, robust federal program to support that. Community colleges already have been doing that. They have food banks. They are dealing with housing insecurity. I've spoken to community college presidents that actually do delivery services of food and groceries to their students and their families. So those sorts of very communal and very community-centered behaviors of community colleges is something I think the Biden administration would like to take to a federal level and promote federal support to things that are already happening in various states and in various districts and various community colleges.
You mentioned that difference between what candidate Biden proposed and what President Biden is actually able to do or is doing in his current role. What do you see as the role of states in this, in helping to fill that gap between the promises on the campaign trail and the realities that you're seeing for community colleges?
I think a willingness to partner with the federal government. There's always a little bit of reluctancy, and this goes across the political spectrum, because states don't really want the prescriptiveness of having a federal partner, right? Someone telling them, this is how you're gonna do this, this is how we want these things done. Some of that can create a chilling effect in various states, especially at a point where states are looking at their tax revenues and saying, I don't know if I can maintain our financial support for this program. If that's a stipulation of federal support, that might be an issue. So President Biden has not made a formal proposal as to what he wants to do. But I've spoken to folks at the White House who say that that is forthcoming. I think right now the big thing is getting the rescue package in place, and then we'll start talking about how to get congressional support for all of the ideas that candidate Biden promoted.
Access to education is often contingent on access to funding. And just as we've seen the scaling back in the stimulus proposal, there's a question about whether we will see a scaling back on the commitment to student loan forgiveness. What are you seeing in that area, and how does it affect community college students?
So the interesting part is that the fact that we've been having this conversation blows my mind. I've been covering higher education for several years, and this was kind of a wishful thinking idea of the very kind of far left activists. And the fact that this is a part of potential policy right now is amazing. So as you're probably well aware, you have Senator Warren, most of the progressive caucus, as well as Majority Leader Chuck Schumer saying, we want $50,000. No questions, no means testing, no caps on, you know, how much you make and such, because that would do a couple of things. It would knock out the debt for about 75% of the population that owes money. It would potentially start to narrow some of the racial wealth gap, because Black students owe more, they borrow more because of the legacy of racial discrimination. They just don't have the resources in order to afford college. Biden has always said 10,000 is his number. The reason being is that before the pandemic hit, it was pretty much understood that the people who were defaulting on their loans, who are really, really having a hard time, often owed less than $10,000 in debt. Reason being is they likely dropped out of college before being able to complete and before amassing more debt. So those are the folks that would benefit the most, in his perspective, from that $10,000. As I'm sure your listeners would know, there are a lot of people who are against any kind of debt forgiveness at this point. Questions about fairness for people who did not go to college. Why should they have to support this? Questions about what about people already paid back their loans? And then a big argument about this is a regressive policy that would primarily benefit wealthier, higher income folks. The issue there is that it doesn't take into account the racial implications, right? There are higher income Black borrowers who still have a potential of struggling to pay back their loans because they don't have the wealth and resources if they were to lose their job, or if a family member, which is very common, were to need help. So having to think about the nuances of this issue is something that Biden has to consider, and to my knowledge, is considering at this point.
That level of vulnerability that people face. So even people who have obtained a degree and been able to get into a job or profession that allows them to pursue their interest, as you mentioned, there's still that difference between income and wealth. And the people who are often most affected by that gap are the people that we keep saying education can be the pathway to the future, and how you are able to pursue the American dream, however people envision that. What do you think needs to happen in order to bring people together? I know there was a discussion at one point about a summit on higher education emphasizing community colleges. What would you like to see happen to really raise these issues in a full way and to be able to stimulate some of the policy changes that need to happen?
It would be useful to have the Biden administration host some sort of summit and really talk to borrowers and talk to current students and talk to prospective students and talk to their parents. I mean, we have to, when we're having this conversation about debt forgiveness and who's holding all these loans, parents. There are a lot of parents right now that are staring down retirement and have tens of thousands of dollars in debt that they took on for their children's education because they want to be supportive. They were told that these are the things that you have to do for your child to be successful. There needs to be a really honest conversation and deep look at who is borrowing, why they're borrowing, what does this say about our values? What does it say about the shift away from looking at education as a societal good and towards an individual good? It's been decades of certain forces kind of hammering home that belief that this is an individual benefit, when we used to, as a society, think of education as a societal benefit. And an educated population makes for better voters, makes for more educated and informed citizens. But that moved away. And it, you know, there are a lot of people who say it moved away as the people who were going to college became Blacker and browner. And there was less of a kind of having state legislatures who are funding state colleges seeing their children in that population. And there's something to be said about being able to distance yourself and cut money when you don't feel like people like you will benefit. So it takes a lot of coming together and talking about what's really happening. And not just having conversation about debt cancellation, but also having conversations about college affordability, the cost of delivering education. And then also the diversity of education. You know, one of the things that makes the US so remarkable and why so many people come here is just the wealth of options that are available. You can be a plumber, you can be a welder, you can get a graduate degree, you can do all those things here. But the one thing that the federal government is supposed to be able to do is ensure that all those options are quality options. And that's what the Biden administration has before them. How do you ensure that students have choice, but they're all quality choices?
Danielle Douglas-Gabriel covers the economics of higher education at the Washington Post. Danielle, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Disrupted is produced by Katie Tularski and Anna Elizabeth. Our intern is Shekinah Collier. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.